Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 199 of the Distraction Pieces podcast, and it's a bonus episode. As I've mentioned, there's going to be a few bonus ones in the coming weeks. It's not going to be every week, but this one, for example, I wanted to squeeze it out early because it's with Charlotte Haffley, who's amazing, and it's a wonderful chat. But there's an event that she's doing on April 22nd that I wanted to tell you all about kind of a week in advance to give you time to grab some tickets and that, because I'm sure it'll sell out. But it's called Space Rocks, and it's in association with the European Space Agency. And Tim Peake will be there, the astronaut, Dr. Matt Taylor, and loads of other amazing panellists. And it's at the Indigo 2 in London. So I recommend that. And that's what I said. That's one of the reasons I was like, I'd rather rush this out now than kind of allow it to wait its turn in the huge backlog of episodes I've got at the moment. We speak a lot about the music industry in this because we're both from the music industry and in the music industry. And we talk about the support, how important it is of having, you know, a loyal and excited fan base. And by chance, this podcast is brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com, which is where you can go and support and buy stuff. There's podcast merch, there's record label stuff, there's everything else. Check that out. I will also, I should mention as well now, I'm doing a live Distraction Pieces podcast. It's the first live one, or the only live one of this year, I think. I'm now looking at my phone to get the exact date. I know it's May 20. I'm deflating. It's May 27th. I'll be at the Wells Comedy Festival doing a live Distraction Pieces podcast. Anyone who's heard them before or come to them before, you'll know they normally last 2 to 3 hours. I've only got an hour slot, but we're going to pack it. It's going to be exciting. The way I do the live ones is, you guys in the audience are the guests, so it's essential that you come or there isn't a show. So I urge you to come. And yeah, the way it works is I have a table, or I have a chair and mics set up on stage, and if you have something you'd like to discuss or a question you'd like to ask, you come up and we discuss it. I have people message me every month or so saying, would you ever consider having an ordinary person on the podcast? Just a regular guy or girl. And that's what the live ones are. It's regular people. Because everyone's got things they're passionate about, or stories to tell, or subjects that they feel deserve discussion. So yeah, that's the Wells Comedy Festival. Come along to that. There's loads of amazing stuff there all weekend, if I'm honest. There's Lemmy's there, Richard Herring's there, Sarah Pascal's there, Rod Gilbert I think is there. There's loads of really good people, so it's worth spending the weekend there. I'm going to be on the Saturday night, on the 26th, I'm going to be at the book club, because I've got my club night at We Are Lizards, with our guest that week is Doc Brown coming down and doing a DJ set, former podcast guest Doc Brown, so that'll be great. But yeah, grab tickets for that now if you can. I'm rambling on. I'm telling you to grab tickets for Space Rocks on April 22nd, for Wells Comedy Festival on May 27th. Really, all you need to do is listen to this wonderful podcast. I'll be back at the end. Obviously, I mentioned on Wednesday, but next week, it's the 200th episode. This is incredibly exciting. It's with Jess Tom, who's amazing, who's a comedian and an actress and a performer and a creator of arts. She also happens to have Tourette's, so it's just a wonderful conversation. I really enjoyed it, and I think you're going to enjoy it too, and it was a perfect fit for our 200th episode. So I'll be back next week with that, but for now, this is episode 199 with Charlotte Haffley.
This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. my backup. Because out of 190 episodes, I had one that I recorded, and then I got to my hotel to check it, and it wasn't there, and it was heartbreaking.
So who was
It was with Ben and Jerry's.
No, okay.
Not the actual Ben and Jerry, but people from Ben and Jerry's.
Right,
UK. Before we started, we were talking of healthiness. That's the epitome of the opposite. But it was a great. I got to go to Ben and Jerry's headquarters, and they've got this like barn, and they've got all the flavors there, and you can have a free ice cream.
Right,
it was amazing.
That does sound special.
I've done the this is now a double podcast trope in that I've started casually mid conversation, and then the new podcast trope is acknowledging that's a podcast trope. So now it's just, it's so meta. But I'm joined by Charlotte Hatherley. How are you today?
I'm all right, thanks. I've got an enormous headache.
Oh, no.
It is just like a mushroom cloud.
Is it too much coffee or not enough coffee?
Well, I'm trying to quit. So it's partly coffee. It's partly I've got all these, I've got a terrible back at the moment.
Right.
I've got shoulder problems. I've been working very hard.
Yeah.
So it's like a perfect storm and it's just massive. But it's all right. I'm going to plough through.
What's caused your injuries? Is it, because again, like touring life, people don't realise, the gigs aside, it can be really bad for your health. Like I used to have my back kind of realigned. And then when I was in a run of tours, I just stopped because I was like, there's no point. I'm getting it fixed. And then I'm sitting in the back of a van for four hours and then sleeping in an uncomfy bed. And
it is designed to make you feel
awful.
Terrible. But when I was 25, 26, I had all these jaw problems. I got like TMJ and I slipped a disc in the left-hand side of my jaw. And I had like really clicky jaw and then the click stopped. So I went to the dentist and I said, that's a good thing, right? And they're like, no, you've worn it away.
Oh, wow.
So I slipped a disc and then I just had all these problems and headaches and shoulder problems. And then because I play guitar, the strap goes across my left-hand side and that exacerbates the problem. So I started doing yoga. I've been doing yoga for like 15 years.
How's that been?
Amazing. It's only the last 5 years I've really taken it. I started doing it for physical stuff and then I got all these mental health benefits from it. And I got really into it. So that's really saved me, I think, because the artists I'm working with at the moment, we've been traveling around carrying just like massive flight cases.
Yeah.
And I'm just not as young as I used to be. I can't deal with it.
I mean, you've kind of had the bulk of a lifetime in that touring life, which again, isn't that healthy physically. I remember the first time I saw you live, I was way too young, and we're around the same age, so way too young as well. And it was a V97, and you were in front of 50,000 people.
That was my first gig.
With Ash. Again, I was thinking about it last night, because I look back now and think, I didn't know what to do at a festival there. I drunk too much, I dehydrated, I was a mess. And years later, I became a festival veteran, and I could do them right and get the most of it, but then realising, and you were on the other side of that.
Well, I had
around the same age.
I had guidance.
Yeah.
Sort of guidance with, you know, you have a tour manager and adults around. But that was my first gig. And I think we did warm-up gig the day before, or maybe it's a couple of days before in Belfast. That was actually my official first gig.
Amazing.
And then we did V97. Yeah, and I wish I could access my 18-year-old brain. I just can't remember how I felt about it or what was going through my mind. I was obviously shitting myself.
Yeah.
I was a pretty shy girl. I mean, I had been in a band for like two years previously.
Yeah.
A band called Night Nurse. And we'd done a lot of like the London circuit. So I'd gone from the Dublin Castle to V97.
Yeah.
And it was pretty mental.
That's mad though, because it can't be. It can't have been easy, particularly at that point, being that. Or I guess it was a time when there was an openness to a lot of young bands. I also remember at V97 was Radish with Ben Queller, and he was about 15 or 16.
Baby.
So it seemed to be a time when there was, not that it was a niche or a novelty, but there was an openness. You didn't have to be a grizzled veteran. You could be these young, exciting, passionate bands. And Ash were a great example of that, because particularly early days, they were so kind of squeaky and
yeah,
arms hanging out of their clothes kind of thing. Yeah. Yet were being quite rocky. And I don't know. I know it feels like a few years later, they would have been turned away at the door every time. I said, come back in 10 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, when you've grown some stubble and got some scars.
Yeah, sure.
But it felt like that was a time where you could go, no, let's just hear this excitement.
It was an exciting time, but it was on the back of Britpop. I think Ash was like, because they were from Northern Ireland, they were really influenced by Nirvana and Weezer.
Yeah.
American rock. So I don't think they saw themselves as part of the Britpop scene, but obviously they were.
A Girl from Mars and all that, I completely associate all that artwork and everything as part of that Britpop.
Well, I used to record Steve DeMack's The Evening Session onto tape and listen to it on the way to school, and I had Jack Names of Planets on like a compilation tape with next to like the Blue Tones and Sleeper.
Yeah.
And I was so lucky. I was 16 when Definitely Maybe and Blur record came out.
Yeah.
And I was in a band rehearsing at the same place, like at the Fortress, which is just around the corner from here, in like Angel, Islington. And Elastica were there, Pulp were there, Suede were sort of hanging about.
It
was mad. And I was like 15 when I joined my first band. So they were around. And then when I joined Ash, you were suddenly like sharing festival bills and backstages with all these people that... It was pretty mad, and it was such a special time for the music scene. And I'm actually a patron of the Music Venues Trust, and a lot of what we talk about is how venues are closing down left, right and centre, and especially rehearsal spaces.
I was going to say practice rooms as well.
Cause
I guess you're lucky in that way that you grew up in London.
Yeah, I did.
Right, but at that point in particular, everyone was kind of migrating to London, so all these... A rehearsal room in East London, in South London. All
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
You could have walked in any day and bumped into a Blur, an Oasis, or whoever. Yeah. So you take that away, and you put it all into the bedroom, which is great that technology has progressed, that people can record at home and all that kind of thing. But you can't become part of a scene or build a community in that situation.
No, and I think it's really important the connections you make when you're part of that scene. And there are people that I bump into now who were in bands at the time, who've gone on to manage bands or even work at labels.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, do you remember the legendary Fortress rehearsal studio parties? And it's just a nice common thread through all the bands that I've worked with. There's always people that I was hanging out with when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And it's very different. It is very different these days. I think it would be really hard to be a young band.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
unless you've got money.
Again, you've got... It's a great point there as well, because it is in those situations that you start to learn and realise that there's more to the music industry than just being the person holding the guitar or the person holding the microphone. Mm. If you're in those circles, you can gain the experience so that even if your musical career doesn't quite go how you'd want, you can learn that tour managers are a key thing and sound men and engineers and all these other kind of areas of the industry that... Again, if you're sat at home, all you can see is the finished product. You can't see everything that's moving behind it. If a bigger band are in that practice room, they've probably got a driver who's bringing them there.
Yeah,
and they've got all these other things that who are waiting around and you can talk to and learn. I know it sounds almost fantastic to think of it, or a fantasy in some way, but there are all these kind of old roadies and all these other things that you can go, oh, wow. I'm actually not that good a guitarist, so maybe I can do that instead.
Yeah, but also these days, there's a whole thing about diversifying, because the music industry's suffered a lot.
Yeah,
as has print media and a lot of artier things. So you don't get that specialised thing.
Yeah.
So you get like a tour manager who does sound, who also drives, who does a bit of this, a bit of that.
Completely.
And it's almost like a sort of that phenomenon of like a bass tech or a lighting engineer, someone who does a very specific job, and unless you get to a level where you can pay for it, you're not going to be able to get that. And I think that is a shame.
And it's a bit of a weird gif, isn't it? Because the record industry, the music industry has changed hugely on the record side of things, on how people make money, but live is as big as it's ever been. It's kind of at a peak. You kind of see bands
the most important thing.
Got their album out yet, and they're playing, they're headlining at Brixton. So it always, I look at that and think it's a bit of a jip when they're turning around and saying, oh, we have to have a go as tour manager, this, this, and this. Like, well, the live part of it, that's the bit that you should be paying.
Yeah,
you
know totally.
I mean? That should all pay, that should feed itself as such.
Yeah, totally. You have to put investment in those early stages, or else you're not going to get to that stage where you jump up to the bigger venues. And, you know, I've been doing session work for years now, and I've played with all sorts of different people.
Yeah.
And you can see, like, the bands who've got label support behind them compared to the bands who are, like, sort of left to their own devices or even doing it independently. All my solo stuff I do independently.
Yeah.
I pay for everything myself, and I have to cut corners, and it pains me at times. I'm like, God, if I had the budget, you had all these grand plans. But then, you know, there is something to be said about working within constrictions.
Yeah, which is completely. But it's learning the advantages of pushing those constrictions. Like, I stopped touring 3 years ago now, and it was only on our last ever tour, after 10 years of touring, that we had a lighting guy.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise how much of a difference that made. It was the best performances we've ever done. I felt like a rock star rather than just me on stage, and it felt like it changed everything.
Yeah.
And I was so frustrated that we didn't spend out on that earlier. We kind of had that overly cautious thing of, oh, we can't really afford this. It's like, do we need a lighting guy? There's in-house lights and stuff like that. And it made all the difference. So
yeah, absolutely.
It is a weird one. It would be nice that.
Yeah, it's just like you never really want to compromise on what you want to do.
Yeah.
Like with I've only got a few solo gigs coming up, but I'm like projections and all these like sort of aesthetic considerations. And then when it comes down to it, I'm like,
how much is that?
How much is it going to cost? And can you justify it, I suppose?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's the justification of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Particularly in an industry where a lot of the pay on live, there's a guarantee and a potential upturn, but the potential isn't guaranteed.
Yeah.
So it's that fear of you could come out of it having not spent much because you've been cautious, and then it all sells out and you break 80% or whatever, and you get this extra windfall, and then you're kind of like, oh, I wish I'd spent more.
Yeah, I've made the mistake of being like, oh, I'll just do it myself.
Yeah.
And like for videos and things, and maybe because I'm a bit of a control freak, but also for like budget concerns.
Yeah.
And then you just end up like working so many hours on something, and you're like, I should have just spent 200, 300 quid for someone to do it. I mean, 100%. That's, you kind of like learn after a while. It's like, it is worth paying someone to do a good job.
I think that's,
everyone
think
that's, wants shit for free.
I think that's a great thing to learn though. I think a great way to learn the value, even just of other people, is to have done that job yourself and go, oh, right. Because again, initially you'll start off and go, well, they're all here to see us. It's our songs. Why am I paying this person this much? If you do a tour where you're doing the driving yourself or the tour manager yourself, you suddenly go, oh, that's why I'm paying them this
much. Yeah,
you know, warrants it. So I think it's a good way to learn the value of everything in the industry.
Yeah. That is very important not to cut corners, I think, especially if like you say, like the live aspect of it is so important, and that's where you're going to get signed, or that's where I've got a gig next week where it's all like, oh, Jules Holland's a TV plug is coming, and I'm like, fucking hell.
Oh dear.
Got to be good.
Yeah. Is there, I think, something that comes to mind when I look at your career is the benefit of being grounded or being humble, because you've always kind of, or after Ash Cunning, you branched out on doing solo stuff, but as you mentioned, you did also play with other bands,
and be a
session musician. There was no, I'm the artist here.
Yeah,
it was like you jumped on with people, and I'm sure we did a few festivals together when you were with Bat for Lashes, and
Bat for Lashes
had an amazing live show and an amazing. Always made me think of your Prince and people like that when you think of Bat for Lashes or Prince as this individual, and then you go to the show and you realise that they've put together this whole collection of talented artists to bring that performance to life. So was that important to you to go, right, no, I'm a musician. Regardless of if I'm at the front of the stage, in the middle or at the back, I need to be creating and part of this.
Yeah, I think I never, when I did my first solo record, I mean, I was still with Ash. And I think I just wanted a creative outlet because I knew that those songs would never be on an Ash record. And yeah. I did some co-writing with Tim and Mark, but I was perfectly happy to just do it. And I'd met Eric Drufeldman, who was the producer who played with Captain Beefheart, and he was a friend of a friend. And then Rob Ellis drummed on it. I collaborated with PJ Harvey, and so I met these like amazing collaborators. And I was like, well, why wouldn't I do that? So I just did this sort of lo-fi little record and had really no desire to be up front on stage. And when I left Ash, I mean, I did another record, and then I did do some solo touring, but I realised quite quickly it wasn't really right for me.
Right.
And I always thought that I should, I mean, I started out as a drummer, and I always thought, you know, that suits me. Yeah. To be at the back and
right, yeah,
sort
yeah,
of
yeah.
feel like strong and stable at the back.
Yeah.
And so when I worked with them, I started doing more session stuff, and actually meeting Natasha was quite a big turning point for me because I'd had 2 or 3 years of not really knowing what I was going to do. And it's like I was like 26, 27, and I broke up with my boyfriend, left this band that was such a huge part of my life. And I didn't really have any income. I didn't really have any money. Hadn't saved because, you know, I was young and stupid.
Yeah.
And then I met, well, actually the first thing I did was some Brian Ferry session work, which Amazing. Was hilarious. And I got this voicemail saying, do you want to go to Kazakhstan with Brian Ferry and play guitar? And I was like, uh-huh.
That's insane.
Yeah. So I can't, it was like just this whole thing that was recurred through my like career of just like random contacts of yeah. like someone recommended me. And that was that. So I did lots of corporate. It was all corporate gigs.
Yeah.
So it's like private jets and like Russian millionaire parties Amazing. And Sardinian boats. And it was so silly and so much fun. And then I met Natasha when I was 30, and she's the same age as me. And we just really connected.
Yeah.
And that was the first woman that I'd actually been in a band with and played yeah. with. And that was 2 years with Natasha, maybe two and a half years. And then after Natasha, I played with Katie Tunstall for 2 years. And then I sort of did another solo record. I took a big break from it. And I guess I just always wrote on the side.
Yeah.
And I had this collection of stuff. But every solo record I put out, I think that is the last time I do that.
Yeah.
And I'm always sort of drawn back to it. But it's not out, really not of a desire to... draw attention to myself. I'm much happier to be at the side of stage in a supportive role, and that really makes me happy. And I've been so lucky. I've just never worked with dickheads. I've worked with wonderful people.
It's a great way to write, is if you can break yourself from that cycle of, oh, I have to write an album, tour it, release. Do you know what I mean? So you become in the industry.
Yeah.
If you're thinking, oh, I'm done now, Then when another album comes, it's because you've got something to say musically and you've got something to get across and get out, rather than
because you want to
there's demand for it, or there's this, or I need to get back on stage, or things like that.
Yeah, and I think now, like with this new record, I released it last year through Pledge Music, and then it's coming out properly in June. But doing it that way, you're free from any time scales, and you just release singles when you want to release it. I mean, it's almost coming up to a year since it was out via Pledge, and I'm doing another single, and there's no like, oh, you've got to deliver something 3 months up front to radio or anything like that.
And all festival seasons on its way, so we need a single before then. And this
like, no. And I do live gigs that I want to do, because I do so much touring with other people. Like, the last thing I want to do is get in a van and play the same venues I've played 100 times on. So when this Space Rocks festival came up, which we'll talk about, I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll get into that in detail.
I was like, yes, that is exactly the sort of gigs that I want to do for my own thing. And then I spend the majority of my other time working with different musicians.
We'll get on to Space Rocks next, because I want to just nerd out on sci-fi stuff and space stuff for a big chunk. Originally, I was going to start with that, but I know you... your fan base listening will be pleased that we've talked about a music for at least a good section of how was it? I mean, you mentioned that working with Natasha Khan was the first time you'd worked with a female led band. The kind of where Britpop happened, it was kind of at the end of the rock and punk thing in the UK, where you had bands like Kinnicky and female based stuff. But when Britpop then blew up, it gradually morphed into quite a lad culture type thing. Mm-hmm. By the time it was Blur and Oasis, and it was at Redden and Leeds, and it was quite blokey and geezers and lads.
Yeah,
and I think it's one of the reasons that you stood out a lot as a female in the middle of that, as I should come into this kind of world of it. How was all that at the time? Was it something that ever felt strange or uncomfortable, or was it something that you only reflected upon when you were then in working with women that you were like, oh, right,
this is how
it could be or should be?
It is interesting how my opinion has changed now. I think at the time, the first band I was in, Night Nurse, the singer was like this Israeli riot girl.
Yeah.
And she introduced me to my buddy Valentine and actually quite a lot of American sort of riot girl scene, which was very female heavy.
Yeah.
Which is slightly before Britpop.
Yeah.
Like L7 and Hole. Completely. And I was a massive fan of Siamese Dream. God, I love that record. Darcy, and then later Melissa Aftermer and all these like female musicians. PJ Harvey, I loved. So and they never made a big deal out of me being a girl and playing guitar at school. I don't remember my dad or my mum ever making a big deal about it. So I never felt like it was weird until I joined Ash, and then it was like such a massive deal. It's like, wow, they've got a girl.
Because it's that external thing that suddenly it's made a big deal out of nowhere. It didn't feel as if Ash thought twice about it. It didn't feel as if you'd thought twice about it. But as soon as the pop media got involved, Enemy or whoever else, it was like, there's a girl.
Isn't
it's
strange?
Kind of so nerdy, isn't it? It's like, girl, I know. There's a girl over there.
It's so weird.
Right, play it cool.
Because, I mean, maybe they were, kind of poppy pinups at the same time as being indie.
Yeah,
and so I got a lot of girls saying, oh, you must be sleeping with Tim, or, you know, sort of weird jealousy.
Of course, yeah.
But it was funny, really, because I look at photos of me at that time. I had short hair, I was skinny. I was just like a, I looked like a sort of just so young and like a little boy, really. I wasn't a sexy young girl at all. And it took me years, really, to be comfortable with that whole thing. Yeah. And then after Free Your Angels was like number one record, there was a lot of me and Tim got asked to be on the front covers.
Yeah.
And then the being a girl in the band became more of a thing.
How did you find that? Because it is always the external thing. Because, again, I remember it very well as being not only there's a hot girl in the band. And, again, if you've grown up never considering yourself that or thinking yourself in that way, on one side, it'll be quite nice. Because it is. It's like, wow, this is weird. Empowering. I look at who I am.
Yeah.
On the other side, it's like, well, fuck, I'm a musician. That isn't all I am.
Yeah, I used to get a lot of, oh, you never smile on stage. And you get reviews. I know, and I'm like, have you seen the fucking state of the other boys? I mean, they're not exactly looking like they're having fun.
Yeah.
And it's, and then you get like reviews or live reviews and be like Ice Queen, Charlotte Hatherley. And I think, I don't know whether it's like, maybe I had a certain aloofness about me on stage.
Right. Yeah.
Because I was shy and I'm a bit older now and that has got easier for me. But at that time it was quite hard and we drank a lot and I had to have several drinks to get up on stage and be in that sort of rock performance mode. And then when I left and then I did other session stuff and meeting Natasha, I think, really softened me because I had this quite a hard shell, I think, that being with Ash had sort of made me toughen up.
Right.
And I felt like I couldn't show any weakness, really, because I was the only girl, not just in the band. Like, we toured with 14, there was like 14 blokes on the tour bus. And there were no special favours, and it was sort of made clear from day one. It's like, we're not going to carry your bags.
Yeah.
You look after your own shit.
Great.
And, you know, and that was been really good for me to have that sort of instilled, because now I became very independent. However, I felt as though I couldn't be girly. I couldn't be emotional. I didn't want to cause a scene.
Yeah.
And I think I shrugged off the questions of what's it like to be a girl. And I was like, whatever, it's not no big deal. And I think as I got older, I thought, actually, no, I do want to talk about that. And it is important. I just didn't want to draw attention to it. So anyway, the funny thing with meeting Natasha, because she's such a fucking massive hippie.
Yeah.
The first day when we got on a tour bus with her, her tour manager was giving out these little stones, like gemstones.
Amazing.
I was like, put this under your pillow. You could put this under your pillow. My initial reaction was like, oh, my God, what is this? And that you get on the bus and so you have your little gemstone, and then it's green teas and face masks, because we had a female tour manager, female merch girl. Sarah Jones was drumming, and it was like... it was like a pajama party every night. And it took me a while, but then I was like, actually, this is awesome.
This is really nice.
This is better.
Yeah, this is a better way to do it.
Yeah, and I sort of softened up. And then after, then I toured with Katie. And then I've actually recently spent 2 years touring with Birdie.
Mm-hmm.
And as I get older, you know, I was always the youngest.
Yeah.
And now I find myself sort of becoming the oldest in the band. And I love it. I love playing that role of sort of, you know, cumulative experience.
Yeah, and it must be nice to have that feeling, because if your first gig is in front of 50,000, or first gig with Ash is in front of 50,000 people, and then when you decide to do your first solo stuff, you've got a profile already, so there's already demand and expectation. You must always kind of feel that you're catching up, or am I meant to be here? The constant feeling everyone has of imposter syndrome. Whereas now you're at a point where you can go, well, actually, yeah, I've got a lot of experience and I'm comfortable and I know this, rather than that constant experimenting on your first solo stuff, but instantly you know it's going to get reviewed in NME and in all these places.
Like, yeah.
Well, I'm figuring it out, man.
And it's interesting working with younger artists, because you can see the pressure and the promo treadmill that I've sort of went through with Ash. And I really understand it, and the insecurities that you go through when you read back interviews. Oh, my God, I'm so glad I was at that. It was just before social media and Twitter and that stuff.
Yeah.
And, thank God.
Yeah.
God, it makes you insecure.
Yeah,
it's horrible.
Again, it's that it's throwing a million questions at you in one day and then expecting you to answer in a way that you stand by for the rest of your life, let alone for the rest of that day.
Yeah, in it's a world on the where...
spot. Answer this. What is it like for...
in a world where everything's black and white and there's no... like, you have to have opinions and you're not allowed to change your mind. I mean, I've read stuff back that I've said in interviews. I'm like, that is absolute bullshit. Like, I didn't mean it.
It's good to change your mind. It should be a positive thing.
I change my mind all the time.
I have people call me out on all sorts of stuff going, well, you said this a few years ago. It's like... yeah, I hope I've improved in the last few years.
Yeah. Or sometimes you're just trying out a theory, you're feeling something out. I learned very quickly not to do that.
Yeah.
In an interview context.
Yeah, exactly. It's a tough one. So you've got the Space Rocks gig, which looks amazing to me. It's in association with the Space Agency, and it reminded me instantly. I did these gigs for years with a Robin Ince and Professor Brian Cox. It would be a scientist and then a comedian and then a musician and that cycle. And they were gigs I did every year, and I accepted them almost forgetting I had to actually get up and perform and do something, because the excitement was seeing everything else that's going on. And this is with Tim Peake, the astronaut, with Dr. Matt Taylor, who I know is a listener of the podcast, and all sorts of amazing people. So how much are you excited to play, and how much are you excited to just be there and watch and learn and take everything in?
Yeah.
It's kind of a tough balance, right?
Equal. I mean, I haven't done a live gig for years a solo live gig.
Yeah. And your last album was, a story of an astronaut. So it's why that fits, and it's why it's a perfect place to
exactly. Be doing this. Well, I did. Yeah, this record, True Love, is it's a really personal collection of songs written in the aftermath of a breakup, and I had taken quite a long break from doing solo stuff. So I released some songs under the name Silver Tongue, and that was it's like a massive indulgence of my love for 80s sci-fi films. So yeah. It's very like Mad Max, Fate for Leather Trousers, quite outlandish, chainmail. And then I released an EP, and then I sort of got asked to do the soundtrack to this short film, which was by Gavin Rothery, who was a sci-fi concept artist, designer, and he worked on Moon with Duncan Jones.
Oh,
and
wow.
Super cool. And so I wrote the soundtrack for him, which took a few months. And then, as a return of favour, he directed the first video for A Sign.
Fantastic.
So we had this massive like sci-fi geek out, and it was all low budget. It was only four of us, but we went down to a beach and filmed me dressed up as an alien, as an ode to sort of Tarkovsky, Man Who Fell to Earth, sci-fi realist, realism. And then when A Sign went online, Mark McCorcoran from the ESA got in touch with me. So he said, I got this message from the senior advisor at the European Space Agency saying, hey, we do lots of collaborative work with musicians. I really like this. And do you want to meet up? And I was like, yes.
Amazing.
It was like exactly what I wanted, really, because I wanted it to be very cinematic, and I suppose because I do music, this is such a huge part of my life, like the industry side of it and touring and all that stuff. I don't listen to music to relax, and film became my thing. And I thought, if I want to switch off, I'll go to the cinema and I'll watch film, and got really into soundtracks. Listening to film soundtracks rather than music by people, by bands. And so for it to connect with that sort of audience, so to work with Gav on a short film and then to meet Mark, it was just so cool. And then through Mark, I met Alexander Milos, who put the festival together. And I think, Mark's so good at connecting people.
Yeah.
And I guess part of his job at the ESA is to go beyond the science, probably quite inaccessible science side of the whole thing. And he's such a great communicator. He does all these presentations all around the world. And he is fascinating to talk to and just wants to bring... And he's a massive music fan, so he just wants to bring the science and the culture together and make it accessible to kids. So there's a big like daytime stuff, which is great for families. And then I think they're going to get, they'll have film people and a couple of bands, and then Tim Peake.
Yeah.
So cool.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah. And it's like a special event rather than just, another gig.
Yeah. I love it. It's a thing that I think you learn from being in the industry for a while, that you're going to get a lot more out of it if you switch your focus to doing the things that you're excited to do,
and
rather than the goals of this chart position or this venue or whatever else, which you do fall into in the industry, it's natural. But when you can go, oh wow, I'm working with people who worked on Moon and things like that, that becomes the excitement. Yeah. And then I think the beauty there, like all artistic endeavors, is you've achieved your goal once you've made it, rather than on the viewing figures or on the record sales or anything else.
For sure.
The goal is achieved once you've done that, and then the rest, it doesn't really matter, which is far more rewarding than living off social media's reaction to it or this or that or anything else.
Yeah.
Like, no, we made it.
Yeah.
That's the goal. That's the achievement.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm kind of at the stage with social media where, I'm not massively well known, really. So the people who follow me or respond to stuff, they're just nice.
Yeah.
I don't get any horrible people. So the people who get in touch are sort of genuine sci-fi fans.
Yeah.
And, this is the kind of when I look back at the assigned video, I think, oh, that's quite weird, I suppose. But it's the kind of thing that I think is cool. And then you just meet other people who are, like, mad into it.
So
makes me happy.
Let's talk about sci-fi a bit. I want to talk about what you've got planned for the performance, if it's going to be nice and simple or bespoke for the event. But let's just talk about sci-fi for a bit. When did you become a big fan of sci-fi?
Well, my dad is a writer, and he is also a teacher. And he was, when I was growing up, he taught at London Polytechnic.
Yeah.
And I used to go and hang out with him. And he was friends with, really close friends with Brian Aldiss. And in fact, he was Brian Aldiss's agent for a while.
Right.
So I would hang out with him when I was a kid, and we'd holiday in Brian's home. And that was sort of my first introduction to science fiction, is through hanging out with Brian Aldiss. And then Dad was also a huge Philip K. Dick fan, and he's like a member of the Philip K. Dick fan club. So yeah, there's like massive collection, like every single book, all these Brian Aldiss books, all these Philip K. Dick books. And I would just look at the front covers when I was a kid of these like books from the 50s and the 60s, really psychedelic and surreal book covers. Like, they just don't do them
these
like that anymore.
Painted worlds that are getting, and Philip K. Dick was kind of the king of the insane concept, and the artists he worked with seemed to be the kings of summing that up in an image. So you could just kind of look and go, that's the one I want to read.
And
generally deliver on what it, do you know what I mean? You've got the idea from it, and you'll jump into that.
And some of them are like terrifying.
Yeah.
And sort of when I got old enough to start reading them, those Philip K. Dick books, I just love them.
Yeah.
They're just brilliant. And, you know, they were written in the 50s and the 60s. But in the 50s, that's when, like, quantum physics and quantum mechanics was, like, starting to be a thing. And so these incredible science fiction writers were, like, writing about stuff that is completely relevant now. Like, even a film like Interstellar is talking about the same stuff that they were, like, 50, 60 years ago.
Interstellar is a prime example of the of how sci-fi can advise science, and one of the stories from Interstellar was when the director was trying to depict a black hole. He hit up NASA and got all the data, and they sent all the raw data, and he created it. And basically, the technology he had was in advance of what they had, because it's Hollywood, it's industry, and they created it. And then when he sent the images back to NASA or whoever else, they were like, "Oh, what's this?" And they found stuff that they hadn't seen in the data. But when it's translated into this image, it then advised them that they were then able to then go and study and get not huge amounts more, but a bit more understanding.
Yeah.
Of a black hole.
That's so interesting.
From a film, from going back and forth, because he had the money and budget to go, well, sci-fi effects, there's huge money in that. That's a huge industry. It's the one thing, or one of the main things, that potentially is going to keep cinema alive, because that's the stuff that you need to see on a big screen.
A
gritty drama, you can wait until it's on Netflix, or you can wait until it's on Sky or whatever else. Whereas if you've got a truly amazing special effects film, you need to see it on the big screen and with the big sound and everything.
Sure.
So, it's a fascinating one, how they can advise each other.
The way that they did the visualization in Interstellar of those, like, multiple dimensions, there's something about, like, I'm visual and I need something to be, like, explained, to, like, shown to me to really understand it. And I wish that a lot of those, you know, like, science books, new science books that I read, or even books about quantum physics, is like, like, I kind of get it, but not really. And then you see it brought to life like that. Yeah. And you can sort of walk. It's almost like, well, you can walk around it like it's a 3D model. Yeah. And you can see it from all the angles. And you're like, oh, right. Now I understand it.
Yeah.
I love that. That's why the collaboration between science and art is so important.
It's crucial, right? Because there's, and I don't think it's a dumbing down or anything like that, but there's a certain amount of people who will go and listen to Tim Peake talking and giving a lecture, or Dr. Matt Taylor or whoever else. But there's a certain amount of people who won't, and they would go to just see the big new film out. So to address things, I talk about this a lot with race and with all sorts of other stuff. I think it's crucial having these stories tackled in dramas and not just in documentaries not just in lectures, but in dramas and fictional stories, because there's a certain audience it reaches that you wouldn't draw into a book, and you might then lead them on to lectures and things like that, but you wouldn't otherwise.
No,
I'm a bit worried about sci-fi, and this is just we're just having conversations that I've been needing to have with people. I think we're at a great point because clearly someone at Netflix is a big sci-fi fan, because there's been Altered Carbon and Mute. Obviously, Duncan Jones's kind of follow up to Moon in the same world. Annihilation, which I've not watched yet, but everyone is saying is
last night.
Is it good? Everyone's raving about it, because I thought Ex Machina was and Dredd, who the director and writer did before them, are two of my favourites. I think they're beautiful depictions of visions of a utopian kind of future.
There are elements of Annihilation that I thought were amazing, and other bits of it that that's actually a good example of a film that I need to watch again. And I think that's not a bad thing. That's actually a really good thing.
And that's the thing that scares me a little, is the amazing sci-fi that's being made. It's a double-edged sword, because I think it's stuff that's being made that maybe wouldn't have been made without Netflix. But all of these, sci-fi in particular, I think is something that should be seen on the big screen. It shouldn't be seen at home. It takes a little bit of the impact and the awe and wonder away if you're watching it on a screen in your living room.
I've got a pretty big screen at home.
Yeah, perfect.
enormous television, but I watched Altered Carbon.
Oh, what did you think of it? I really enjoyed
it. It's got good ideas, but I don't know.
The ideas I really enjoyed. And I thought the main guy was
too many
gorgeous.
Tits. It's like tits, left, right and centre.
There was tits, left,
right. I just don't get why in the future there's strip clubs and tits out and prostitutes. It's such an old trope.
That you see, it's weird because the thing that I remember the most was him being naked. And because, again, I just thought he was... like he looked like a statue. It was like he'd been carved out of marble. I thought it was amazing, but I guess there was a lot of on both sides of that.
I don't know.
It's telling that I was so distracted by his body and didn't notice all the alien tits.
Go back and look at the tits.
I will. Don't worry about that.
Believe me, they're there. Mute had similar issues with.
Yeah.
Again, like really cool ideas, but it was such a throwback visually to Blade Runner. And even the most recent Blade Runner, I was like, it didn't really emotionally engage me. It didn't move me. It was pretty good to look at.
Yeah.
But it's the sci-fi films, like Arrival destroyed me, Interstellar destroyed me. I like to be moved. And that's the sci-fi that I love, where it's like, the human condition being.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of what I liked about Mute, though, was the discomfort in watching it. That it wasn't Blade Runner, it felt you could just sit there and switch off and look at how pretty it was. Mute, I felt, threw up a lot of things that it's like, I don't know, had me uncomfortable as a viewer in the story
rather than
individuals or anything else, which, again, that excites me. I think it's why... Well, I think it then puts it at the mercy of reviewers, because reviewers are watching a sci-fi in particular want
all singing, all dancing. I mean, it was a pretty brutal response to Mute. And I hear what you're saying, because Altered Carbon and then Mute. And Annihilation's actually pretty good. I mean, that was just dumped on Netflix because that wasn't like a Netflix thing. But my favourite sci-fi thing that is a Netflix thing was Black Mirror. And that was that can't have been a massive budget, probably more than you get in the BBC. But the ideas in Black Mirror are phenomenal. And the first episode of the new series was just mind-blowing. The guy who has his fantasy sort of Star Trek.
Yes, of course, the kind of the VR type world
just
type.
Dark thing. And
yeah, it was amazing.
And the script's amazing. And I know that's the stuff that I miss with the sci-fi that I watch that I'm really not that into. It's just like the sort of interesting visuals or interesting ideas, but this just the storytelling. It's like was the Ridley Scott the Prometheus, and it's like I wanted to love it. The script was so fucking terrible. If you can't get past that, then it's a struggle.
I think one of the unhailed geniuses of Black Mirror is the fact that it's standalone stories, and it allows you that if there's one or two in the series that you weren't particularly into, you're still like, that was an amazing series, and all you talk about is the great ones. Whereas Altered Carbon, as an example, pretty much every Netflix series has a mid-season lull, which blows my mind when it's on digital. It's like, just have less episodes. You're in control. You've not got a schedule to fit. But with Black Mirror, there will be certain ones that you're like, I didn't enjoy that much, but on to the next one.
Yeah.
It doesn't make you critique the whole series, because there will be the ones that just blow your mind. And I think that's genius.
San Junipero was like leagues ahead of like the other, for me personally, the other episodes in that series.
Yeah.
But that was like fucking amazing.
Yeah. And Hang the so DJ good. In this recent series as well, I thought was
Hang
just
the DJ and the dating one.
Yeah.
That was brilliant.
Yeah.
And you know, like simple stories, not a big cast, not loads of like effects.
And that's what I like. I like in the first series of Black Mirror, I enjoyed it, but I came away thinking half of those episodes I would have enjoyed just as much if you just told me about it in a sentence. Like the Prime Minister has to fuck a pig. And it's like, that's all I need. I didn't actually need to watch that for an hour. It was these cool little ideas that I don't know if they benefited from becoming a drama, because the drama wasn't necessarily there. But that's changed as the series has gone on.
It started off quite nasty.
San Junipero is a perfect example of that, where it's all about that emotion and that relationship. And
there's a warmth to it. Whereas I think the early, like the Prime Minister fucking a pig one, there's a sort of spiky nastiness to us. Yeah. And it feels like there was a softening in San Junipero, and it was just a beautiful love story and really sad.
Yeah.
And it throws up these ideas of like this uncomfortable future that we might be facing and the decisions that we'll have to make.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what happens when we start to live much longer in our relationships?
Yeah.
How is that going to work? How does monogamy work when you live till 150 or 200 years old?
Yeah, completely.
And it's just like a forum to explore that. And that sort of appeals to me a lot more than, I don't know, Altered Carbon seemed just so violent and it just didn't really work for me.
The thing I enjoyed about Altered Carbon, and not to do a whole episode
aside from his abs,
aside from his amazing body,
statuesque ass,
was just the fact it was an old school private eye type thing. There's a mystery and I'm going to figure it out. And I've not... It instantly made me go, I can't remember seeing anything like that in a long time, outside of European crime dramas. Mm-hmm. But again, it's still a crime drama rather than kind of, we'll figure it out, see?
It had
that feeling, but in the future, so I enjoyed that. But I also completely get a lot of the criticism of it. What's your thoughts on Stranger Things? Because that's a divided one, because it's drawing so much from the 80s, sci-fi that I get the feeling is where you fell in love with it. Yet it is a modern kind of thing.
Again, it's got that warmth to it, Stranger Things, that I really like. It's got that sort of E.T., Goonies sort of feel-good factor. Obviously, the soundtrack, I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, but it is bloody brilliant.
Yeah,
it's amazing. I just think it's cool. It's just cool kids.
Yeah.
And
I think if they hadn't come up with the character of Eleven, it'd be completely a run of the mill.
Yeah.
But that character feels like a character from an iconic 80s. Like, if that was an 80s thing, then that'd be in there with your Carries and different things like that, of your horrors
absolutely.
And stuff at that time, that you're like, remember that character.
It is like Carrie, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love the fact that Winona Ryder's in it looking perpetually perplexed.
Yeah, yeah.
It's cool. I mean, I really like Stranger Things. And it's got that sort of surrealist fantasy element to it, in a sort of Pan's Labyrinth way of those sort of films that I also love, which is, they're not quite sci-fi, but they're in this other sort of dimension.
Yeah,
they're in that sort of upside down place, sort of almost in a Twin Peaks world. Like the latest Twin Peaks was just mind blowing for me, and you wouldn't say it was science fiction.
Everyone says again that last series was just—it's
so good. It's just so good, and his sound design is so experimental and like fucking out there. It's just like TV that I've never seen before in my life.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't... It's certain elements of Black Mirror. I don't know if it's quite sci-fi. It's more like fits into that Twilight Zone kind of TV, where it's sort of fucked up, weird, stuff, but like Philip K. Dick's always playing with the ideas of like perception and is it a dream or is it a reality? And
yeah,
it's you know, it kind of straddles those two worlds of surrealism and science fiction.
Have you watched any of the Philip K. Dick Electric Dreams series? I've recorded all of them, but I've not watched any of them. It feels like some of the casts in them are amazing. Mm. There's some amazing people in it, and obviously there are all these Philip K. Dick things. But
I didn't love it.
You didn't love it.
I didn't love it. I'm sorry.
And was it a kind of overall feel, or was it? Were there any kind of Black Mirror type moments? And, that one was cool, but that one was shit.
Oh, I can't really remember. I didn't watch them all. The Timothy Spall one was quite good. It was quite dark and gritty and depressing.
Yeah.
But it's funny because now you have Black Mirror on Netflix and then you see the BBC budget compared to that, or where.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what channel it was, but it didn't. You could see it.
Yeah,
it felt Doctor Who-y.
Yeah.
And I don't know, now I'm so used to stuff being like looking
slick and wonderful.
Yeah.
And sci-fi is one that will suffer from that. Again, a genius thing is your Strange Things going, oh, it's 80s.
Yeah.
Which means you can have that feel. Because again, I can watch an 80s sci-fi film and it'll feel great. Mm-hmm. If I watch a modern sci-fi film that probably looks better than the 80s one, but because it's modern, you can't accept it.
Yeah.
Tinny.
Yeah.
And rubbish. So, I mean, we won't just talk all day about sci-fi as we get towards an hour mark. I'm going to go a little bit more. What would you think of what comes to mind as your favourite sci-fi film?
I love Solaris so much.
Yes.
I just love the fundamental questions of the human condition that it brings up, but it's set in space on a spaceship, and the aliens or this alien planet is sort of probing these humans' minds.
Yeah. I've not watched it in ages.
Oh, it's so good. It's bringing back ghosts, and it brings back the character's dead wife, and then he tries to get rid of her. He blasts her off into space, and then she comes back again, and sort of making the people on the spaceship sort of confront their deepest, darkest.
Right. Yeah.
And that's just the stuff I love. And visually, it's bloody beautiful, and the soundtrack's incredible as well.
Yeah.
And I like Stalker. So that I guess the sort of Tarkovsky films that are. They're not big budget, fancy looking things, and they're, you know, very talky, but they're just sort of, he's just had a really beautiful way of looking at nature and the human condition and existential questions. And it just happened to be set in the zone, which is like this sort of weird part of the world where aliens have taken over. Just weird shit happens, but it's more about the conversations between the humans. And then I love The Man Who Fell to Earth.
The key, though, isn't it, is realizing, and I think it's something a lot of people, or you can love or hate Marvel films, but I think where they've found something is where they've realized that superhero isn't the genre. It's just a mechanic that's in there. There's your Ant-Man, which is like a rom-com, and then there's your Logan, which is like a western, and things like that. And I think that's the key to good sci-fi, and it feels a lot of the modern stuff, the recent Cloverfield again on Netflix,
right,
is an example where, again, I didn't hate it, I thought it was all right, but it was one where it felt like they've got one little idea and then they've made that the film, rather than having the drama and the relationships
between
the people. Even though Alien and the whole series was this amazing beast, it was the fear and the drama that Ridley was going through that drove that along.
Yeah.
The fact that Sigourney, that her child had died while she's in stasis and all this, and there's all these motherhood things going on there and all these dramas, and then protectiveness. There's so much going on. It's not just imagine a really scary aliens attacking.
Yeah,
that's part of it, but there's so much more in there.
Yeah, and I mean, I love Alien.
Yeah.
I love The Thing. I think The Thing's brilliant. I guess the films that are like before CGI takes over. So like the great thing about The Thing is that it's all sort of, you can see the handmade model element of it. And same thing with Blade Runner. You can see like the tactile model building elements of that world.
And so much of the reliance on, again, all the greats of horror kind of state, it's all about or what you don't see. But at that point, the hand was forced on that a lot.
It
was like, oh, we can't actually show you that.
So it is
all about, let's make it all, but that made it great. Whereas now there's the excitement of, look how great or scary we can make this look, or great we can make this look. It's like, but is it, or what's it adding other than a few zeros onto the budget?
Exactly. And then a good example is that of it is Mad Max, the original Mad Max is... Yeah. Where it's just like a few cars in the desert and it's mega low budget, and there's nothing to indicate that it's set in the future.
Yeah,
there's like nothing visually to indicate. It's like I love those sort of dystopian films where it's like future primitive.
I think that's what I liked about, or one of the things I liked about Mute. Again, it's not like it's my film of the year or anything. I keep coming back to Altered Carbon and Mute as if I'm defending them. They were both But the thing in Mute was something that Mad Max had, was it was one of the first sci-fi films I'd seen in years that had stuff left over from the past. And it hadn't occurred to me that so many sci-fi films seem to have this assumed premise that, well, we destroyed everything that's here now and built everything new. Like, again, in Blade Runner or anything else, it's all so shiny and new and wonderful, whereas Mute had some dirty old buildings and some dirty old cars. And that was the beauty of Mad Max, was there was some futuristic elements, but loads of it was like, this is just what's left.
Yeah, exactly.
We've come to the future and we're running out rather than increasing and improving.
Yeah, yeah. How do you feel about AI, the film? Spielberg one.
Yeah, I liked it. Again, I've not watched it in years, but I enjoyed it at the time.
I love that film.
Yeah.
I love it. That's one of my favourites. And it just, I don't know why I love it so much.
Because
it's not perfect, but I... just moves me so much when I watch that
again,
film.
It's another one that's playing with a raw emotion of fear of being caught out, of being found out, and this kind of thing. It's like this, it has you on the edge.
It's just
like
a little boy searching for his mum.
Yeah.
And then at the end, made me think about it, because it's like just the whole city is underwater.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are like the books that you read now, like if you've read Homo Sapien and other books about like where Michio Kaku... books, where are we in 100 years time, like slightly terrifying futures. I mean, there's no, I'd like to see some sort of utopian sci-fi, but then there's no drama. Like, who wants to watch something where shit's going really well?
Yeah, it's all going great.
So it's like everything has to be slightly miserable. There's a lot of sort of,
otherwise you get a Demolition Man, which I love for its kitschness, but again it's just this perfect world, everyone's
right. Yeah, exactly.
And you have to bring people from the past to cause the trouble and drama.
Handmaid's Tale is absolutely brilliant.
I've seen
but
it.
Oh my god, it's horrific. It's such a horrible watch. And you know, that's something that's incredibly relevant. You watch it, they've sort of brought something that I read at school into the future. So they're talking about Ubers and like relatable technology, and it feels like part of why it's so terrifying, it's like that could happen, or that is happening in certain parts of the world.
I have to watch that.
Oh, it's horrible.
Did you say Dread?
Yeah.
The one I thought was so underrated.
I really liked it as the
cinematography of it, everything was beautiful. Yeah. It's wonderful. It's the first film I'd seen in 3D that I felt the 3D added to it. Mm-hmm. They'd shot it, that used 3D for beauty rather than just, look at this! Surprise you. It's like the raindrops pouring on you as you watched it.
I really like Dread.
Yeah.
I quite liked the remake of Robocop with the dude that you love from Altered Carbon.
I've not seen it. How often is he naked? Because
only really got a head.
I'll give it a miss.
He's got a bionic body, though. So, okay.
You're piquing my interest. So I'll wrap things up. What have you got planned for space?
Space rocks. That's a very good question.
Because it's a tough one. Do you just do what you do? Because that's why they want you there.
Yeah.
Or do you bring in elements? And then there's that fear of, oh, are the elements I'm bringing in, are the actual scientists, that going to be like...
I know, yeah.
She thinks she's bringing in science stuff, and you're like, no, honestly, I...
They have been so generous with me. So the ESA made this special... Oh, I'll go back. I saw Mark do a presentation, and part of this video was the constellation of Orion... sort of fast forward like thousands of years, and
yeah.
I was like, that was cool. And he said, if you like, we can make it, you know, any length that you want. And so I had this song, did a cover of How Deep Is Your Love,
yeah,
and it was 6 minutes long. I was like, well, actually, that would be really good for that. Could you make it 6 minutes? So it turns out that stretched out to 6 minutes, it's 3 million years, and it's just the stars moving apart, and it's very hypnotic and sort of trippy. So I use that, and then you can go to the ESA website and download videos, and you know, it's all out there for free for anyone to use. And then Mark sort of gave me access to like the full length videos of stuff that I liked.
Oh, wow.
Sent them over, and so I made this video out of it. And I think what I'll do for the live thing is I'm going to have projections, so it's going to be sort of a big visual thing. And I'll use a lot of the ESA space footage. I'm going to hit Mark up for some stuff. He's been talking to me because he worked on the Rosetta mission.
Right, yeah, of course.
And he was like, there's lots of footage that
can
be used for that. And I'm just going to integrate it with the music. And then I'll use a lot of the footage of the video I did with Gavin.
Yeah.
And see what happens.
I love that subconsciously... You spoke earlier of feeling most at home on the drums in the background, and you've turned a solo performance into you essentially being in the background.
I'd like to be in the dark.
If the video is taken over, it is one of them where I've gone to see films before where there's a live score, and I always feel guilty for getting lost in the film. Because I feel I should be appreciating that there's a band here and doing this and that, but that's not the point. You're meant to be taken in, and that kind of, if it feels like this, it's literally a solo show, yet you kind of want everyone to be looking somewhere else.
It's very true.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a good thing, right?
True.
Come full circle.
I mean, I think...
You found a way to make your solo stuff with you as a supporting artist as well.
Yeah. That's... Yeah, it's probably my way of, like, just shying away from the centre stage, definitely. But then again, I just think it would look better.
Yeah, completely.
It will look better than just, I don't know, these days I'm like, I like seeing stuff that is interactive, and I've seen loads of like live film scores, and it's brilliant. In fact, I did one for the short film I did. I performed that live at the BFI as part of their space and science season. That was amazing.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I want to do stuff like this. And if one thing that I wanted to do, but I haven't had time to get it together, is Gavin edited... it's like a sci-fi greatest hits of all these different sci-fi films, and
amazing.
He put it together to 120 BPM, and it's at 20 minutes, and we will get it to like half an hour, and then I've written the soundtrack to it.
Oh wow!
And it's proper industrial, and I wanted to put that in the middle of the set, and then I just thought, just play your fucking record.
Yeah.
Stop. Yeah. Complicating matters, because I think that's the thing. I the danger of when you put a record out, because I finished it a long time ago, in my mind I'm like, I want to do something else now. I'm like, people haven't really heard it, and sometimes I've got to put the brakes on myself and be like, just stand still and sing the song
completely.
Don't need to dress
it
up.
That's the only downside of being your own boss in that situation, and that you release when you want, you do the gigs when you want, is, in your mind, these songs are getting older and older.
Yeah.
Only a handful of people have got the chance to see them live before, so they're brand new to them, so you need to give them
that
kind of respect, I guess.
And I think it's that confidence thing of being like, you just singing a song with a guitar or piano or keyboard is enough, and not feeling like you have to... like deliver something so mind blowing.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes the most powerful thing you can do is just strip it back.
Yeah, completely.
But I think that's there's such a bravery in that that I haven't quite. I'm going to have to sort of think about that.
I think a key as well is if you can hold back the imposter syndrome enough, is remembering that there's loads more gigs to come. There's loads more ahead. So you can do a gig that is purely soundtrack in that 30-minute clip thing. It doesn't have to be, it's easy to get into the mentality of, but this is the big gig. Like,
This
is the big gig at the moment.
Yeah,
this wasn't the big gig a year ago, and it won't be the big gig in a year's time. So it's that kind of... that awareness of, right, I don't have to get everything in this. I can do this for a standalone thing.
Yeah.
And then the next thing is the big gig
that I
get excited about.
That's the good thing about working with other people, because my focus isn't completely on my record.
Yeah.
And it does take the edge off it, because I think if it was, I would be worrying every single day about this gig. Yeah. And instead I'm like... I can't think about everything.
Figure it out.
Yeah, it'll be fine. And
lovely.
I really can't wait to do it. And then hopefully there's another gig during the second Long Division Festival. I think Billy Bragg's playing that, which will be cool. And then, you know, hopefully other ones will come in.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Keep up with you online or throw sci-fi films at you to see if you've seen
them
and see your opinion.
Well, I'm on Instagram, Charlotte Heatherly, Twitter, CHeatherly79. I have got a website, but mostly through Facebook as well, Charlotte Heatherly Official.
Perfect.
And the album's called True Love.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been lovely.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was episode 199. People often ask why I don't ever have people on the podcast I disagree with. I think you will hear that me and Charlotte disagreed hugely on how sexy the man from Altered Carbon was, and how that, made up for any... shortcomings in that may be perceived in any other way. I do all the time. There's these hard, we talk about the hard stuff and we debate it. That was Charlotte. As said, go and check out Space Rocks April 22nd at the Indigo 2. I think I've got the date right, but you just Google Space Rocks Festival and you'll find it. It looks like a lot of fun for the family and everyone involved. So that'll be great. I'll be back next week with episode 200. It's very excited, isn't it? Do get tickets for the Wells Comedy Festival as well, please. Distraction Pieces podcast there. The show revolves around you guys being there and you guys engaging and being part of it. So I really hope you come. I'm driving a long way. It's a 4 or 5 hour drive. I've got my club night the night before, but it seemed like a cool one to do. I've not done anything out that way in a long, long time. So I thought it'd be good fun. So hopefully I'll see some of you there. And have fun. See you later. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.